characteristic of what we are, whether we're 4 or 4 million. We start with that. And it's around that that we build a movement. And right then, it was the question of program that was key. That's why we just didn't denounce the bureaucracy and lack of democracy in the Communist Party and in the Communist International. We didn't collect together all those who saw that there was something undemocratic happening. We had to collect those who understood what the defense of the Marxist program meant. That was the key thing that we started on. Could have had hundreds of more members in the beginning if we had done something else. We just said, well, everybody who's for democracy in the Communist International, collect with us. Whether you're a right-wing opponent of Stalin or a left-wing opponent, that doesn't matter. We said, it does matter. Because the big thing here is that the program of Marxism has been abandoned by the Communist International, and we have to rescue it, defend it, and rebuild again around it. Now, one of the key things we did, though, in the beginning, as we began to recruit people, and Cannon had contacts from his work in the Communist Party. Was to stop the Stalinists from physically breaking up our meetings. And that meant to call for united labor defense of our meetings. And there were some big battles. I mean, these wasn't just a simple little thing of locking arms and told the people to go away. They came in to try to break it up. And so there were pitched battles with clubs and things and other things too sometimes. But we won. We defended ourselves, and that was an important question. Some of the people we later recruited were Stalinists who were sent to be thugs to break up our meeting. So in the first year, we gathered our first cadres. About 100 members at the end of the first year. In 1929, held our first national conference with 100 members. Did three things. Adopted our program, adopted a position on the Russian question and on the Soviet Union, because there were those who wanted to say, well, since there had been this degeneration in the Communist Party and the Soviet Union, there was no longer anything that we had to become anti-communists. And they had to answer no, and that the Soviet Union still remained a worker state, and it had to be defended. And we had to adopt a question of what is our attitude towards the Communist Party and the Communist Party workers. Because there were some who said, well, let's take our little 100 and go out and just go directly to the working class, and we'll build a party just against the Communist Party. But we decided no, that was wrong, because still the best workers were in the Communist Party. They were still the most revolutionary-minded workers. And it's that you couldn't go around that vanguard. You had to try to do everything possible to win from that. Those people who were at the highest level politically that could understand what we were talking about. You know, the debate of socialism in one country. Can you build socialism in one country or not? Or in a backward country or not? Well, it might sound like a very, you know, it's an interesting theoretical question. We could sit around but it was the key question. It was the key question. Can you imagine if we could go back in time today, go back to those debates to those Communist Party workers and say, here, let's show you now, 1990, where this has led. See Gorbachev kissing Bush's ass? See him say he's for capitalism? That all comes from socialism in one country. It all came from that. The whole role and everything of... it came from the bureaucracy, but it was difficult things to understand. It was the Communist Party workers whom we could had to go to try to win. Then, for reasons we won't go in here to here, Stalin made an ultra-left turn in the Soviet Union and in the Communist International, from a rightist turn to an ultra-leftist turn. Through the forced collectivization of the peasantry, the biggest single blow that the bureaucracy made against the worker state in its history, aside from destroying the Bolshevik Party and the Communist International, betraying the world revolution, but inside the Soviet Union, smashed the worker-peasant alliance, drove down agricultural productivity to one-fourth of what it was, which it didn't recover from, didn't get back up to 1928 levels until the 50s. But this meant a big left turn, too, throughout the whole international. And many thought that Stalin had adopted the left opposition's criticisms. And there were former supporters of the left opposition who went back to Stalin. They said, oh, he's going good now. He wants to industrialize, which is one of the things the left opposition said had to be done. And they called for revolution everywhere, and Soviets everywhere, which was just fake and crazy. That's why it's ultra-left. It's not a real revolutionary policy, but just a policy imposed from the outside. Once again, the Communist Party, for example, in this country, said we have nothing to do with the American Federation of Labor. We've got to build red trade unions. And they tried to set up their own unions. But at the same time, while this turn was made, this helped isolate us. It made it more difficult for people to understand that this was not a genuine return to the revolutionary road. But some people mistook it for that. Some of the big leaders that had been blocking with us in Russia capitulated to Stalin at that period. Radek and Zinoviev and Kamenev and others went back to Stalin. But there was something else that happened. We had gone into a world depression. And while unemployment was growing here in the United States, the Soviet Union launched the first five-year plan. It looked like it was going forward. It was going forward, in at least in that aspect. The Communist Party began to grow. We looked like doctrinaires, going around explaining what was wrong with socialism in one country and other theoretical and political questions. Why weren't we getting with it? Okay, you got some criticisms, but look, they're going ahead. They're building. Look at us. We've got unemployed lines here and soup lines and misery, but the Soviet Union's going forward. That's the road forward. And they began to track revolution, radicalized workers, and we were isolated. So we went through the whole period from 1929 to 1933 of what Cannon calls the dog days. pretty difficult times, being isolated. And in times like that, sometimes you recruit some freaks who like that. You know, we're ready to be small if we have to be, but we don't want to be. Some people want to be. They like a little tiny group to be. They don't want to get big. They don't want to have reach a lot of workers or anything like that. That was one problem. Another big problem was money. We never had enough money. They didn't have a telephone. Somehow they got the militant out every 2 weeks. Got pamphlets out. Even put out a big book by Trotsky, Problems of the Chinese Revolution, which educated a whole layer of comrades on the theory of the permanent revolution and as it was applied to China and what the real Bolshevik policy was that should have been applied. The Stalinist policy had led to defeat of the Chinese Revolution. And we continued with programmatic clarification of our members and supporters in this period. And we got a big help from Trotsky, who by this time had been expelled from the Soviet Union, and who helped cover world events. One of the big ones that he helped us with and that we wrote about was the question of Germany. From 1931 on, he had pounded away that the fascist danger was real in Germany and what needed to be done to fight it, that it would be a terrific defeat for the world working people if the fascists took power against the workers. In this ultra-left line that the Stalinists were on at that time, they downplayed the fascist danger. They said, the Socialist Party are fascists too, so we can't make a bloc with them against the Nazis. Everybody's fascist, except us, kind of. Refused a united front to fight the fascists. And when Hitler was appointed chancellor, which marked the beginning of the fascist counter-revolution, the Communist Party failed to fight. They failed to call the workers into the street with arms to fight the Nazis. That meant they were defeated, the workers were defeated, without a fight. Trotsky had been hammering on all along, the socialist and communist parties must form a united front to physically smash the Nazis. That this was a real threat. In their ultra-leftism, the Stalinists said, oh, this doesn't matter that Hitler's been appointed chancellor. After Hitler will come our turn. That's empty phrase-mongering ultra-leftism of the worst. So the workers lost to the fascists in Germany without fighting. This is the worst kind of defeat you can ever have. Far better to fight and go down in bloody defeat, like the workers of the Paris Commune in the 1870s did. Far better, because if at least you fight, you leave an example. And it was the Paris Commune, an example of it, that inspired the whole new wave of socialism, socialist parties that came right after. And the Bolsheviks. Because to be defeated like that without a fight leaves no examples, leaves nothing. And it created the myth, which we still have to combat right here today, that the Nazi victory was inevitable. It was so powerful. What are you going to do about it? How can you stop it? But still we have to explain that, because it seemed that way. The combined votes, even, of the Communist and Socialist parties were way more than the Nazis. And their votes represented more, because they represented the industrial working class, organized in the factories with the power over production. Not the scattered masses that the Nazis assembled. They could have won, is the fact. They would have won if they had fought. They would have defeated them. And it didn't protect them not to fight. Didn't mean that they didn't die. Because what Hitler meant was what happened was exactly what Trotsky predicted in all these appeals to the German workers. He says, fascism will be like a terrific tank riding over you and crushing your bones. And that's what it was. It smashed the working class. Crushed it. Immediately, the Communist and Socialist Party leaders were arrested, all the trade union leaders. They were the first to go. After the working class was smashed, then the Nazis went after weak peoples, like the Jewish people, who couldn't defend themselves. And something else happened then, this terrific defeat in Germany. It was that not a peep was heard throughout the whole Communist International. It wasn't a peep of protest, of questioning, of anything about it. The magnitude of that defeat and the fact that it was just blithely passed over led us to the conclusion that the Communist International was dead as a revolutionary organization. And the task was now to build a new international and new sections of that international throughout the world. This meant a break with our former policy of orienting to the Communist Party and trying to win its workers and trying to reform it, to the conclusion that was no longer possible. The thing, we didn't kill it. I mean, wasn't because we thought it was dead. It died. It failed. It led to one of the biggest defeats of the working class in modern times. Well, this coincided in we're talking about 1933, that there were vanguard forces that looked to us now. We had a bigger audience. We put the militant out twice a week during the German events. You know, this question of money, one of the things they used to do just to get the militant out was that they'd, some comrade would have their rent due. Some other comrade paid the rent 2 months later, I mean 2 weeks later. They'd borrow it from that comrade, give it to this comrade. So he'd pay his rent. And then a little while later, he'd get paid, he'd give it to someone else. He'd go around like that. So you sort of had a floating rent fund to keep things going. It was hard to slog in this time. But we started to recruit workers who were shaken by this, and intellectuals too, and people from the Communist Party, who were shaken by the German events. Masses don't join you because of a defeat and because you were right. Defeats don't help you build a big party. They can help you build some vanguard forces. And we went on a national speaking tour throughout the country. And there were big meetings, 1,500, 500, things like that. Big meetings. People started saying, well, what did Trotsky think about this? He was right here. What did Trotsky think about that? We recruited George Novak out of this. He's just one of others. Then early in 1933, the unemployed movement began to go bigger, and it was under the control of the Stalinists, but they couldn't keep us out like they had up to then, because for their own reasons, they wanted to bring in more forces, and they didn't want to look really weird, you know, picking us out as we walk in the door and stuff. So we went in and began to be able to move into that movement of the unemployed. And there was a development of a new layer of radicalized workers who were repelled by Stalinism. And they began to go into the Socialist Party, looking just for some other big party. We were still too small to attract many forces like that. The SP grew up to 25,000 members in 1933. Then there were other groups popped up. One of them was called the Conference of Progressive Labor Action, which was led by an ex-preacher, A.J. Mustey, who led that, and they organized unemployed, and they began to act in different militant actions and things, and they began to raise the idea that workers needed their own party, and they thought of the idea of transforming themselves into a party. So we saw those developments, and we started to write articles and approach the young people in the Socialist Party and in this Conference of Progressive Labor Action. Workers in this period began streaming into the American Federation of Labor, not through any organizing drives of these hidebound leaders, but just because of the impact of the Depression. We noticed that. In the beginning of 1933, there was another accidental thing where a hotel strike began in New York. And it happened to be some comrades who were employed there. So we were in it. And In this strike, it turned out that the key element of that working class force were French chefs. You had them on your side, you could shut the hotel down better. They played a key role, but most of them didn't speak English. But we had an intellectual who did speak French, and he was capable in all kinds of other ways, named B.J. Field. And we sent him into it. And he became the strike leader. And then, so the whole party went into this battle. At the beginning of the strike, there was a meeting of 10,000 hotel workers in Madison Square Garden, addressed by Cannon. That is, we just came in there. The workers wanted help. We were there to help. Fine. Then a thing happened, though. B.J. Field got a swelled head by all his attention. He thought he knew more than the partyists collectively. He was the big leader. He was the big mass leader. He's the one who all these workers were following. And an aspect of getting this swelled head was that he was easily flattered by the representatives of the bosses, by the government mediators especially, and negotiators. And he became more and more wound up with the negotiations with these people and the give and take and going out with them to dinner and on like that. And he lost contact with the real rank and file and lost contact with the momentum of the strike. The momentum of the strike was lost through these long, drawn-out negotiations. The same time, he refused to meet with the party to discuss things like that. There were some people in the Communist League of America, which was what it was called then, who knew a bit about trade unions, more than this guy did. But he didn't want to listen to them. They could see what was happening to the strike, how it was being frittered away. And it was eventually lost. Well, in the middle of the strike, we put him on trial for refusing to cooperate with the party in working out how to lead the strike. And he was expelled. That shocked a lot of people. What's wrong with you, Trotskyists? Here's your big labor leader. You're breaking your connections with the labor movement. But there are no real connections with the labor movement if your trade union members are just go off and do whatever they want, and especially in the direction of away from the interests of the class. Anyway, this was a negative lesson. You know, it was a kind of a test of ours, of us. Here were these hair-splitter Trotskyists, finally they're leading a big strike, and what happens to it? Doesn't end up too good. But then it was soon followed up by a positive example, and this is in a couple months, so it wasn't such a long wait, of Trotskyists in action in the great strikes in Minneapolis in 1934. There were three big waves of strikes in the 30s. First was in 1933, which this hotel strike was one. Most were defeated. Then in 1934, there were three big strikes that were successful. San Francisco general strike, I think led mostly by the Stalinists. The Toledo Autolite strike, in which the Mustiites, this Conference of Progressive Labor Action, provided a lot of leadership, and the Minneapolis trucker strikes, which were under the leadership of us. And then that led to the big wave in 1936, 1937, the massive wave of strikes, the most powerful wave that created the CIO. Now we had some real tested comrades in Minneapolis. They were some of the people we recruited from the old Communist Party, who had known Cannon for a long time, people like the Dunn brothers, Carl Skoglund, and others. And they all worked together in a coal yard during the Depression. Long hours, terrible pay, back-breaking labor. But they had to work, they had to eat. That was what they were doing. And they began to see that there was an opportunity to organize some of these coal loaders and drivers in these couple of coal yards. We don't have coal much anymore for as much use in homes and in factories like this, but it used to be like that. So they organized the yard. And they led a 3-day strike, which was very successful, very well organized. Those of you who heard Lynn talk about Minneapolis yesterday, about how it used to be known as Union Town, and now after the governor used the National Guard to attack the Hormel strikers, some union-busting outfits thought that Minnesota might be a good place to come into. Well, before the 34 strikes, Minneapolis was a completely open shop town, run by the employers and run and terrorized by a group called the Citizens Alliance, a group of the employers who had beaten back unionization attempts. Well, from their base of winning the strike in the coal trucking place, they went out and tried to organize the truckers in general. And they had success, because the success of this first strike meant a big shot in the arm for workers in the whole city. They oriented towards the AFL. That meant they had to orient towards the Teamsters. The Teamsters were a little tiny union of milk drivers and things like that, not what we think of it today. But their idea was not to form, it was to go towards the labor movement as it is. That was one of the lessons. Not going to be able to go into everything that happened in these strikes. I think I'm going to have not get to 38. Because we have to... maybe we should start. What do people feel about it? How much do they want this to go or to have questions? Okay. Well, this already. This orientation to the American Federation of Labor was not so easy. Our comrades had been expelled from the American Federation of Labor in the 20s. But they realized that's what they had to do. If they were going to win, they had to get the power of organized labor behind them. And here was another piece of luck, though. The head of one of the Teamsters locals, whom we affiliated with, was a guy named Bill Brown, who just happened to be a class struggle type fighter. And he saw these new forces come in, and he opened the door to them. And he said, and he opened the door. They hadn't been in the industry long enough to be elected officials or anything, our comrades. But he was. So he helped them set up an organizing committee of the Teamsters local, which soon became the real leadership. It wasn't the elected leadership, but it was the real leadership of the local. And it went out and organized the truck drivers. He liked people who knew how to fight. And he saw them in these coal fight. So they went out and got a lot of the truckers organized. And they did something.